Who's, let's see, I guess we have exam two graded now. The grades are posted on Blackboard, the distribution is up, and so we'll talk a bit about that. I'll hand the exams back today. I think it's always wise advice to actually take the time to go through the exam to figure out. First of all, make sure you understand each problem, and then at that point, ask yourself if you're grading fair. If it is not, then there's a procedure to ask for regrade. If things didn't go as well as you'd like, it's the opportunity to try to ask yourself why it didn't. And I think there's a good number of you that need to go through that exercise because the exam distribution is a little bit odd. It's sort of flat from about 30 up to 100, and that's actually pretty unusual for me. So I'll talk a bit more about that. I mean, so some of that may have to do with the structure of the exam. Some of it may have to do with some of you who did really well, reasonably well in exam one, sort of let up a little, and things are getting a lot more subtle. So letting up a little can make a big impact on understanding and grades. Certainly there was some evidence when I looked through some of the exams that some of you probably have let up the entire semester, and it's really beginning to show now. So when I looked through it, I sort of saw evidence of all that. I saw, a student who did really well in the meeting of the first exam and got really rocked on this one. Okay, I don't know what's going on there. So I think that people need to spend some time looking at that. It's pretty strange distribution. Anyway, I'll hand that back, and I guess we'll all fret about that for the next day or two. But for right now, I want to move on to some other stuff. So the workshops will continue on their Wednesday schedule through the week of Thanksgiving, or their Wednesday through Tuesday schedule. Do you have anything for me? I think you want to pay workshops in general? Okay. Well, glad to see we all survived the hurricane last night. Okay. So we're entering a stage of the course which is a whole lot of fun in some ways. It also is a little less intuitive than some of the stuff that we've been doing. And so one of the things I'll be trying to do is to give you intuition, because in fact there are lots of analogs to rotational motion and linear motion. If you were to let up on the course during a period of course, now isn't the time. Rotational motion is a little fuzzy. It is something that I think seems a little more opaque to most students when they hit it than many parts of physics, in part because it is a little counterintuitive. But it is also something that when you get used to it, it will actually begin to make a lot of sense. And it's not so bad in a sense, but you'll want to get used to it. So one of the ways in which you want to think about rotational motion is really to build on what you know about linear motion already. So I hope that you are all very familiar with this set of equations. We take the definition of velocity and the velocity is equal to dv over dt. And we basically pull the dt over to the other side and then integrate both sides, and we get this equation. We do the similar thing for the definition of acceleration, and we get this equation. And those are really quite general. Okay, they're always true because they follow from our definition of what acceleration and velocity happen to be. Then we make the assumption that the acceleration is constant, and then from these equations we can derive all these others. And under the circumstances where you have constant acceleration, or you have a constant force and nothing else going on, then all of those will work. So we have rotational analogs of each of those, and in order to get at those, we have to think about what we mean in terms of rotational variables. And a way to think about that is that if I do linear motion, that's one thing. If you think about doing linear motion with my arm, okay, all the points of my arm are basically moving through the same distance in this direction in the same amount of time, and life is pretty simple. But the minute I do this, note that if I move all of the parts of my arm through one angle, as I rotate around, my fingertips go through a longer distance than my shoulder. Okay? That means the linear velocity of my fingertips is like that. So if you really piss off at somebody and you want to slap them, step back and slap them like that. You're too close. You're not going to have much of a velocity there. It's not right. But, you know, so what that means is that in the linear space of V and A and sort of the distance, the arc length, the world is complicated because it is different for every point, every radius, because it all scales that way. But if I use sort of the definition of the relationship between the arc length and the angle and the radius, which I hope is familiar to you from horrible high school classes in calculus, you have S is equal to R theta when theta is measured in radians. Learn how to change your calculator from theta in degrees to theta in radians, and theta in radians to theta in degrees, and learn to always check that, right? Because they're different. If I give you theta in degrees and you take sine of theta using the radian thing, you got the wrong number. Right. So now, from this point on in the course, you're going to be playing in both lands. So you're going to have to, you know, just be careful about that. This equation only works when theta is measured in radians. And the way to think about radians is simply it takes 2 pi radians to go around in a circle. Two pi radians times r, 2 pi r, this is also the circumference of the circle. So that's where all this fits together. Once you have that, though, you can take the derivative of each side. R isn't fixed if you want to think about, if you were just doing rotational motion, you think of a position at a fixed r. Then the derivative of this is just a linear variable, so that's a velocity. The derivative of that is an acceleration. So we now create something new. We say, I want a derivative of this theta, and I get omega, which is the angular velocity. It is the change in the angle with respect to time. All of the points along that radial line are changing with that same angle. So that's the advantage of the angular variable, right? If I move to here, every point along that radius has the same angle. Move to here, same thing. So as they move together, they all share the same angular velocity, even though the linear velocity changes. Same is true for the acceleration. So there are a couple of ways to do this. One of the things that we have done in lecture is to literally go through the same procedure that we did in the linear world in the angular world and derive one of these, not all of them. But basically, by virtue of omega being defined as d theta dt, this equation follows. If all you do is pull the dt over and integrate both sides. Same is true here. So these, just like those, are completely general equations. Always true. They call on the definition of theta and omega, of omega and alpha. If you assume that you are in a world where you have constant alpha, constant angular acceleration, that is, it starts spinning faster and faster, but the rate of change is constant, okay? A little harder to picture than linear stuff. Then you can pull alpha out and derive all of these equations in the same way we did for the linear case. Another way to do it, which is sort of simpler once you realize that there's this mapping, you can take this equation and you can substitute r theta for v, r theta 0 for v0, r alpha for a, okay? And basically the r's all cancel out and you get this. I said r theta, I'm sorry, r omega and r omega 0. And so then r cancels and you get that equation. You can play the same game here. You basically just map them off using this set of equations. Okay? And then you will have problems that are very similar to the one-dimensional problems that you dealt with in constant acceleration, except now you have constant angular acceleration. So you sort of have to learn how to do those types of things. So, you know, you drop a ball starting at y0, how fast is it going? And it drops down a certain distance, y. You have something that starts at omega zero accelerates with a constant alpha, what is the omega after so much time, right? It's the same problem that you sort of have to develop that inhibition. You okay with this? Any questions about all of this? So things get a little more complicated when we try to carry this linear angular extrapolation a bit further. So the operational equation that we deal with in Newton's laws is this F equals ma, which in fact is a vector equation, and you know that vector aspect complicates the world for you a lot. The same is actually true for the angular piece, but for the moment I want to ignore the vector piece. We're going to come to that either at the end of this class or next class. The analog to F equals ma is something called torque equals I alpha. And the issue here is that you have to take into account some subtleties about circular motion. So for example, I can push on a door with a certain force and cause it to rotate. I can give it an alpha, right? But if I take a specific force and I push here, I get a pretty decent alpha. If I push here with the same force, I don't get really squat. Right? It depends on where the force is applied. And you've all almost broken your nose at the doors at the bottom of Wilson Commons. I know I have. If you hit the wrong side of that door, which somehow is set up deceptively, so I do it 50% of the time, you put the same force, but the door doesn't open, so you walk right into the thing, right? And then you're like, you know. How many of you done that? How many of you done that comparatively? So the force necessary to cause an angular acceleration depends not only on the magnitude of force, but the point of application of the force. And it turns out that there you are more effective if you put that force at the point that is farther from the axis of rotation. So that's what this R is. So if I have a body here, and this is the axis of rotation, and I put a force on it, if this is the line, sort of the line of the force, if you want to describe it that way, the line along which it acts, the R that we're talking about here is the R from the axis to that line where this is a right angle. So it is literally the distance of that line from the axis. We're going to find a nicer mathematical way to describe that soon, but that's really what you want. I'm not really talking this distance unless I form a right angle right here, okay? It turns out that a way to think about that, it is only the piece of the force that is perpendicular to that distance to the axis that makes any difference. If you come up to a door and you push this way, or you push this way along toward the axis, that force doesn't do anything. It is only the part of the force that is perpendicular to the axis that goes from where the force is applied to the axis of rotation that makes any difference at all. You actually know all this because you're able to open doors, right? So you use it all the time. But that's sort of a statement of a fact. So this quantity where you take the force and weight it by the distance from the axis of rotation, taking into account this sort of directional piece, we call it the torque. The piece that plays alpha, as we've already talked about basically, is sort of a measure of your ability to get this angle changing. The moment of inertia is another sort of fuzzy piece. If a door is really heavy, so it has a big mass, then I have a harder time opening. I have to exert a larger force, or a larger torque, if you want, okay, to get it to rotate. It turns out that if that mass is distributed in such a way that it is further away from the axis, it takes much more torque than it does if that mass is distributed close to the axis. Okay? So, I don't know. I mean, let me calling in wishful, but I don't really have a good prop for it. Imagine that I have a bar with two big masses here. Okay? Let me actually back up a little bit. So suppose that, what do we call them? The girls at football games just spin their little baton. So suppose I have a baton, right? And I'm sitting here, you know, all this picture, the look up. So, pretty cute. So I spin the baton, right? So I'm experienced at the course. You can imagine that that works, right? Batons are pretty light. I'm sure you've all picked one up before. Imagine if it now had two big masses on it, like bowling balls. Now it's going to be really hard for me to turn it, right? It's not just because of the amount of mass, but just the ability to spin. I mean, even if I had a hinge on something, the total mass that supported the ball, I have a much harder time being able to spin. If I move those masses in close to the center, it's going to be a lot easier to spin. All right, so I hope you can sort of picture that. We're going to do a lot more of that later. But what it turns out is that the relevant inertia against angular acceleration is not just the mass. It is the mass weighted by the square of the distance from the axis. So the distribution of that mass turns out to be absolutely critical to understand how things rotate. So if I have a point mass, it turns out, and I motivated this in one of the recent lectures a little bit for you, if you have a point mass, it turns out that the measure of the moment of inertia of that point mass goes as the mass itself times r squared. Okay? If I have a bunch of point masses, I basically want to add all of those up together to get the total angular mass, which is what we call moment of inertia. Generally speaking, you're rotating things that are continuous, not just some bunch of discrete masses, which means we have to go to the infinite sum. We have to let those little masses go to little differential masses and then add up an infinity of them across this whole continuous distribution of whatever it is. So we take this and we integrate over all the little r squares, all the little dms weighting by r squared, and that is the moment of inertia. I don't usually give you a distribution in dm. You usually get a mass density distribution, a rho, which means you're actually integrating r squared times what dm is, which is rho dv. That is a mass, the density that changes depending on where you are, and you take every little differential volume and you take the mass of that differential volume according to what this density function happens to be. And you integrate that. Depending on how the mass is distributed for the object, okay, it could be like a bicycle wheel or it could be like a thin uniform disk. Those are very different things. Even if the mass is the same, the mass distribution is quite different. So you actually do have to do this integral for all these different shapes if you're going to rotate them. I will give you some practice in doing that, and I do hope that you will all pick it up. Okay, you are responsible to be able to do that. That said, I can make that arbitrarily difficult, and we're going to rotate a lot of masses no matter what. So I don't want you doing an integral every time you rotate something in this class. So happily, we have people out there who have done these integrals and made nice tables for us to use. So in general, what you'll do is in a standard rotation problem where the point of the problem isn't necessarily to do that integral, okay? Then you go and you say, what is it that's rotating and what is its moment of inertia? And these are a little bit hard to read, but the moment of inertia of a ring of mass at a certain radius r spinning about an axis through its center of symmetry goes as big the mass of the ring times the radius of the ring. If you have a thick ring, so it's sort of like a thick-walled pipe, it has an inner radius r1 and an outer radius r2, you get this. If you have a solid cylinder with a uniform density in it, and you rotate about the axis of symmetry of the cylinder, it's 1/2 mR squared. Now those are pretty similar, but this is mR squared, this is 1/2 mR squared. If these have the same mass, okay, even the same radius, note that this one is half the size of that one. Why? Most of the mass here, all the mass is concentrated out at large R. It's harder to rotate that than it would be if all the mass is distributed toward the center. Okay? Etc. You have to be a little bit careful. Here's one, for example. If I take a rod and I have an axis right through the middle of the rod and I'm rotating the rod like this, so like a baton, okay? Then this is the moment of inertia. If instead I take the rod and I'm rotating it like that, note the mass distribution with respect to that axis of rotation is very different in those two cases. The integral is different, and you have different moments of inertia. You'll have a bigger moment of inertia when you have more mass further from the axis of rotation. So in the case where I'm rotating like this, there's more mass far away than there is when I'm like that. So that moment of inertia here better be bigger than this one is. And it is substantial, factor 4 bigger. Any questions on... Yes?
Could you do an example of a problem where we're given a density function and we have to integrate
the time? Yeah, probably. Soon-ish. Maybe not right now. But we'll do it. I'll certainly also give you some practice with that in some other, workshop and stuff. I fully am cognizant of the fact that many of you are sitting there not feeling warm and fuzzy about that particular aspect. Okay. But even if you never learn how to do that, I can do the moments of inertia. You have to look at the rotation that's going on the axis, pull out the right one. And the intuition I'm trying to give you is really this equation. Okay? So you have to sort of take your F equals ma and then go into angular space. Alright, so let me not do that example right now because I want to put some thought into picking a good one for you that is instructive. And maybe I have it in my notes coming up, but I think I'm not right here. So let me think about it rather than just pour it out in there. So let us suppose that we have a ball. And let us suppose that ball, think of it as a solid ball, is just sitting here. Okay? What is its kinetic energy? It's zero. Why? Because it has no velocity. So now let me take that ball. And I spin it, okay? Now this thing is rotating. About some axis. What is its kinetic energy? B is zero. So its linear kinetic, translational kinetic energy is zero. But think about it. Do you really think it has no energy? There's a lot of energy in something that's rotating. So we have to have a rotational analog of kinetic energy. Okay? And maybe a way to think about it is imagine that I have some radius out to some little dm here, those little DMs are moving. At any given moment, at a fixed radius, I look at a little piece of that mass, it has a linear velocity. And that's true all the way around. It's true for every piece of mass on this thing except the stuff that's directly on the axis. So in a sense, you should say, well, I can sum all of those up, and then I'll have sort of a measure and say, you know, 1/2 mv² for each of those, and I should be able to get something. So we can think of the kinetic energy of this total thing to be a sum over all the little dms, or little m sub i's, of 1/2 m sub i times v sub I squared. So that's just now the kinetic energy of each of these little pieces, dm, okay? And now, this is basically 1/2, if we go into the angular world, let me back off a little bit. What is v? V is r omega. So v squared is r sub I squared v sub I squared. M r squared is a measure of I, right, for each of these little pieces. So the kinetic energy, if I go into the rotational analog, is equal to 1/2 I omega squared. In this case, this is the mapping, it's not too bad. M just goes to I, V goes to omega. And we have 1/2 mv squared is 1/2 I omega squared. Again, the amount of kinetic energy depends on the moment of inertia, which depends on the distribution of that mass. Yes?
That's something you know.
It sure should. Thank you. Therefore, they'll have the same velocity when they hit the ground. That's just independent of mass. You okay with that? All right. Having said that, I now have several objects, and I want to rotate them down the ramp. Okay, so one is made of copper, and it's heavy. That's in kilograms, so it's almost 6 kilograms. One is made of wood, same size, going around, but much lighter. Okay? Now, in this case, we actually have friction. I can't get rid of it. So these things are going to roll rather than slide. Yeah, I wish I had something in the friction. So what'd you see? The heavy one's in back. Which one won? Alright. This one goes faster. Why? Its mass is bigger. Why do I care? Depends on how it is. So the mass is bigger, right? Let me do a different example, a slightly maybe better. So we have two that are roughly the same mass. They're not exactly, but they're pretty close. So it's almost one, and it's almost one, all right? In one, I have mass concentrated at the center and less out here. In the other, I have mass out here and less in the center. Which one of these is going to win going down that hill? This one? Or this one? Think about it a moment. Intellectually commit. Raise your hand if you think it's this one. Raise your hand if you think it's this one. All right. Drum roll, please. Wasn't even close. So what's going on? Soon they both have the same force of friction down at the bottom because the normal force is the same, right? That force of friction basically is what's keeping them from sliding this way, which means there's a force that is that way on them down here, okay? So you have a force that is separated from the axis by this distance, which is the same in both cases. In the angular world, we call that a torque. So they have equal torques. If the moments of inertia were the same, that would give you equal angular accelerations. I have equal angular accelerations, they spin at the same changing rate, and it's just like in the case where I have a constant acceleration, they should have the same angular velocity at the bottom. Basically means they should cover the same distance and should be even. But it's not even close. The moment of inertia is very different. Because the moment of inertia goes as the mass weighted by the distance from the axis, which is much greater for this one with the rim of steel around it than it is for this one where you have the plug of metal at the middle. The auto scaling is quite different. So the moment of inertia, though the mass is the same, the moment of inertia here is much greater. So in a case where I have a mass like this, or a mass like this, I here is greater than I there by a long shot. If this is the same, and this I is bigger, that alpha has to be smaller. Okay? If alpha is smaller, this is going to go slower down the ramp. So the one smaller moment of inertia goes a lot faster. So if this were completely frictionless, so that a slid, that is, there was no friction, therefore there would be no torque. So it may strike you as odd, but what that means is this would slide like this. You can see from this it's not rotating. Okay, it would just slide. Okay. Now there are keywords and problems that they use. Okay, if they say a mass goes down a ramp, a frictionless ramp, it's not going to rotate due to that motion. So you can think of it like a block sliding. If they tell you it goes down a block without slipping or without, or with friction, usually they'll say without slipping. What that really means is this surface of the wheel does not slide. It's like a static point, which means you rotate. Normally they'll say rotate without slipping. And that tells you that you have a direct relationship between the amount of circumference you prolong here and how far you go, okay? When the 2 pi r is equal to, this rotates one full time when I go a distance of 2 pi r, right? That's what it means when it says it's not slipping. It also means you have this torque that's going to cause rotation, okay? So let's do an example. Let me suppose that I have a rotating object. This is the kind of object I want to make here. Let's say it's a thin disk. Just go to the new page. So let's say I have this kind of object that's meant to be sort of a uniform disk, not a great drawing, that's rotating. And let's imagine that it moves with a linear velocity. V. So the center of mass moves at a velocity V. And let us say that it is it's a cylinder. Really a wheel. A wheel is really a solid wheel. It's really just a cylinder. It's not super long. Okay. And it rotates without slipping. So we have a flat region. And then we go up some curved ramp sort of thing, okay? And so if I know that I start out moving at a velocity v, okay? The question is, how far up the ramp will the wheel
go.
All right, so the wheel's going to spin, and it's going to start to go up this ramp, and of course, because it's headed up, it's going to stop at some point. And I'm going to use the measure of height to be its bottom. That way we can define this as a zero height. So the question is, what is age at the time it stops? Okay? So how would you do this? If this were just a block, and it's moving at velocity v, I don't have friction in the problem, how would I do it? Conservation energy is the easiest way. So I would set 1/2 mv squared, which is the initial energy to start with, equal to mgh. Okay? That work here. This wheel is moving. All right, so what I actually let me be a little bit more explicit. So let's use conservation of energy. 1/2 mv squared is equal to mgh. The m's cancel out, and you get that the height that you go to is equal to v over 2g, v squared over 2g. Okay. So, does this work? It does. The plot. What are you missing?
Do you have to use the kinetic energy equation for friction?
Friction does come into play, so it is true there's friction. However, if I have a wheel that is moving without slipping, does friction do any work?
No.
There is a force. The wheel is moving. But at every point where that wheel is touching the surface, it's not moving. It's sad. All I'm doing is sort of changing which piece of the surface I'm touching the other. So it is not the same as if I am exerting that force through a distance, like if I was sliding. So you don't really have frictional energy loss in this case. But the wheel is turning, and we have just discovered that you have kinetic energy right sitting in the degree of the degree of freedom, which we call rotation. So this, my friends, we cannot see. So we must do it more complicated. You still start out with, what is the energy you start out with? Well, we know that the center of mass is moving translationally, and we know how to quantify that. So the initial energy is equal to 1/2 mv squared. So this would be the, I call it translational or linear. The linear translational in physics, translation is moving from one point to another, translational kinetic energy. But in this case, on top of that, we not only have this motion, we have this motion. And the two are really superimposed. So we have to put in kinetic energy due to rotation, which is equal to 1/2 I omega squared. Okay? And that is equal to the final kinetic energy, which is mgh. Okay, so really that's the equation you have to deal with, and you'll have to look up in the table for a wheel because it depends on the mass. If you were to see, it depends on how the mass is distributed in the shape of the wheel. I, for a wheel, a solid wheel, a disk sort of thing, I is equal to mr squared, I believe. Good. One shape I don't have. Sorry. So it's just mr squared. Let's use mr squared. And then omega, we want to change omega into V so that we, because we're given V basically. Right, so we have to change that into a variable. We know V is equal to R omega, which means that omega is equal to V over R. So this term here becomes 1/2 times m r squared times v over r I squared. Or it actually just becomes 1/2 m v squared, so that the total energy you begin with is equal to 2 times the 1/2 m v squared, which is just m v squared, and that's equal to m g h. 4H is equal to V squared over G, which is twice as high as we can really get. When we looked at it in the first case, if you assume it's effectively not rotating, which is we forget that rotational period, we get H is equal to V squared over 2G. If you now put in the rotation, it's going twice as high. Why do you think it's going twice as high if you have the rotation in there? Does that make any sense to you? Conservation language. Why does it go up any distance at all up this ramp? You have kinetic energy and conversion potential. Right? Okay. How does the kinetic energy compare if it is rotating or if it is not? If you've got this thing rotating without slipping, okay, for a given translational motion, I not only have this mass moving translationally, giving me the 1/2 mv squared, I have, in addition, the amount of energy it takes to rotate this thing, which turns out, in this case, to be a 1/2 mv squared, it depends on the I. But in this case, it just turns out to be twice the kinetic energy. So if you start out with twice the energy, you have to convert that much more into the potential, which means you go twice as high. Okay? So it's a big deal, this rotational energy bill. it might actually be a good time. Well, let me, before I do this, I want to do an example problem. But before I do that, let us do this. I have a big wheel with the thing that goes through the center, an axis, so it rotates like this, okay? And I have a string that's wrapped around it. And, I don't know if you recognize that, it's a skateboard. Okay. So I got my big wheel. Suppose I now pull this where the force with which I pull it is directly on the axis here. What do you think is going to happen? Sorry, I meant to construct a clicker problem out of this. But I got caught talking to people this morning and didn't have a chance. So this is free to move. The card is free to move. And I now have a force here. Physically, what do you think will happen? What are the forces that are now... Let me ask very particularly, what direction is the car going to go? Is the car going to go this way, or is it going to go that way? So let's call this A, and let's call this B. Think about it for a moment. All those who think it's going to go direction A, raise your hand. All those who think it's going to go direction B, raise your hand. All those who don't give a shit, raise your hand. Well, that's good. There's only one of you. Alright. That's great. Now I know I'm really, really... Okay. So, most of you think it's going to be B. That was actually pretty distinct. Alright. Tell me why. Put it in words. Tell me what you think. Sure. You were the one doing this. So yeah. Which force is going that way? The one I'm pulling is going in certain. Okay. Okay, so the concept is I'm pulling this way, so the wheel is going to turn like that, which makes you think that the car is going to go backwards. Okay? All right. You all said the car goes that way. Ready? It does roll by holding it. Alright, we're going to do the same thing. Now I'm going to exert a force, but it's got a string going around it, okay? And I'm going to pull with the string with the force right here. A. B. Alright. Think for a moment. How many of you think it's going to go in direction A? How many of you think it's going to go in direction B? Why? What's last one in version A, so. Okay. All right. So in this case, I'm just going to hold this up so it's not doing anything. No, it really didn't do anything. We have a not very good skateboard, sorry. It's sort of trying to do that. There's too much friction in the wheels, so sorry about that. The skateboard isn't so great. What you were supposed to have seen is that, in fact, it will go backwards. Yes. Well, if I hold the bar to pull it, then it's definitely going to go backwards. Right. But I don't want to do that. I just want to support it because I want all the force to be due to that. But the problem is, let me try it fast. Well, then it did, actually. I'm just holding this up. Okay, so it does go backwards. So now that you have found that your insight is correct, can you explain to me why physically, as opposed to how does it go the other way? I'm smarter about this. What do you think?
When holding the bar, the radius is for the
front of the zero. Because it's going right through the middle.
Well, the acceleration is also good. So at that point, the force of friction on the actual cylinder is not great enough to move it, to rotate the cylinder on the skateboard.
Okay, so he said something about the force of friction. So he's getting there. Oops. So, look, this is a physics class, so you got to think systematically, and you got to think about what's going on with the forces. Here's the wheel. What are the forces on it? If we ignore gravity and normal forces, cancel each other out for saving magnitude of friction. Here's a force that is sufficient to move the wheel, okay? If I try to move the wheel, I try to move its center of mass, there's a force of friction at this point, which is the force of friction of this cart on the wheel, correct? What direction will it be? That way, because otherwise the wheel slips. The wheel is not slipping. Okay? So if I have a force of friction of the wheel this way, what is the direction of the force of friction on the cart? That's the direction of the force of friction of the cart on the wheel to keep the wheel from slipping. Okay? So there is an equal and opposite force of friction of the wheel on the cart. So if I ask now in this situation, what is the force of friction on the cart? It's to the front. And that's what makes the cart move. It may not agree with your intuition. So you've got to learn to think your way through these things systematically. Right? It moves forward. And the only way to think your way through this problem is quite literally, systematically like that. Otherwise, your intuition is just going to be wrong. Yes?
The first course of friction.
Yeah, if we ask what's going on with the wheel, I know I have one force going this way, but I know the wheel doesn't slip on the surface. Therefore, there has to be a force that way that keeps it from just slipping. Okay? And if it, and because of that, there has to be a frictional force on the cart, which goes the other way. So the force of friction on the wheel has to be that way because it has to counterbalance this one to some extent, otherwise it rotates. Or, I mean, otherwise it slips. But it's not slipping. So therefore you have a force of friction on the cart, which is that way, and that's why it moves. Okay? So what about the other case? Here's my wheel. I'm pulling like that. Yeah.
So because in that situation, though it's not an example, it's really precise, so then the force of friction on the cart in the direction.
So let's see. This thing doesn't just spin. So I'm exerting a force this way. So there is a force at the bottom of the wheel that's like this. Because that way I have opposing torques, which basically keeps this thing from just spinning real fast. Okay. If I have a force on the wheel that, at the bottom, which is this way, due to friction, it creates a force on the cart, which is that way, because it's equal and opposite, which makes the cart go backwards. Okay. So it's sort of subtle. Maybe very subtle. There's a problem like this that will be coming up in a workshop, so and there are somewhat different ways of looking at this. So when you discuss it in workshop, you may find you can discuss it a couple of different ways. Because you can think of a wheel. And we'll look at it in different ways. You can think of a wheel rotating without slipping on the surface as rotating about this point, okay, and translating. So you can have rotation and translation where the two are married together, just like we did in the last problem. Or you can think about it as something that isn't translating per se, but it is only rotating about that point. And it turns out that the moment of inertia is something rotating about that axis, and the same object but rotating about that axis, you'll have different moments of inertia. So you can actually show that the answer you get here and here are basically equivalent. If you want to think of it as rotating here, the point at the bottom effectively has no translational motion at all. The point in the middle moves, and the point at the top is moving faster. If you think of this as sort of moving, think of this whole thing as rotating. So I guess the question in my mind is whether I wanted to go through that way more carefully right now, or I want to do it. Because I've started this, so let's do this a bit more carefully, because my guess is I didn't do that very well. Alright, so if you have a wheel that's rotating, alright, we have this, we have an axis, this thing is rotating about the axis, and we have the wheel that is moving with a linear velocity. So if we want to ask, what is the total kinetic energy? And the total KE, you can think of as the translational KE where you have all points on the wheel basically moving in V. So the linear translational KE, which is going to be 1/2 mv squared. Plus, on top of this, the thing is rotating. So we have this, where we have the top moving at V and the bottom moving at V, and the thing is rotating. And this is going to be the rotation about center of mass. And you know that the outer edge has to rotate at the same speed as the center of mass is moving, because basically you have a one-to-one mapping between circumference on the surface, rotating on the surface, and how far it goes. So if I roll it a certain amount of time, I'm going to have the same linear velocity for how far I move on the surface and this point going around the circle. So what I'm explaining is how I know that this V and that V are the same as that. So if we figure out what that is, then we have a 1/2 mv squared plus this is 1/2 I omega squared. This 1/2 I for a wheel is mr squared, 1/2 mr squared. Times change omega to v, so I get v squared over r squared. So this term becomes 1/4 mv squared. So the total kinetic energy is equal to 3/4 mv squared. So I want to look at it a different way. And in this case, I want to say I have a wheel that does not rotate, that rotates about this point. Okay, and that's the entire thing. So I have it rotate about that point with some omega, which means this point moves with the velocity v at that instant that it's going. And this point moves with a velocity 2b at that instant because it's twice as far away. So at this moment that it's rotating, that you'll have that linear velocity scale with the distance that you are from the center. If I ask what is the moment of inertia of this object rotating about that axis, turns out, you can look it up, it's turned out to be 3/2 mr squared. Okay? There's a thing called the parallel axis theorem that I'm actually not going to drag you through. The book may. Right at the moment I decide I'm not going to drag you through it, that's something which I actually often do in this class, so I might end up changing my mind on very explicitly if I do. But at the moment I'm thinking I won't. But this would be a case where it's very applicable. It basically says if you know the moment of inertia for one axis, you can calculate the moment of inertia through a parallel axis with a small equation that you use. Anyway, it turns out, in this case, let's say you look up the table, you find it's 1/2 mr squared. So now, the kinetic energy, we're looking at it, and we think of it as only rotation. We're not looking at a translational piece because we're imagining it rotating about that bottom point. So in this case, the total kinetic energy is 1/2 I omega squared, which is going to be 1/2 times the 3/2 m r squared, which you get out of the table, times omega squared, which is v squared over r squared. So you end up with 3/4 m v squared, which is the same as what you have over here. So there are two different ways of looking at the wheel moving. You can imagine it as translational motion coupled with rotational motion, or you can imagine it as simply rotating momentarily about that axis, and that sort of is the physical way to look at it. And they are equivalent, but you can't mix them up, right? You can't say I'm rotating about this axis and then put in the kinetic energy of rotation. You sort of have to look at it one way or the other. And you can see how important it is to map the correct moment of inertia onto the problem, depending on what axis you have for the picture. Yes? You okay? If you have a question, come ask me. Alright, so the last thing I want to do today is give you your exam back. And, I would say a more usual distribution at this stage in this class is something that goes a little bit more Gaussian here. So something didn't quite work, and I'm not sure what. I did do some looking at some of the exams. And I certainly found evidence of some things being completely broken at a deep level in a few papers, okay? So barely fix that, or don't expect much out of class. I saw some evidence of people who actually did pretty well in exam one and found themselves knocked down pretty hard on this test. And certainly one thing to ask yourself is, did I do anything different? I have seen in the past, I see it more when I pop 121, because, face it, most of them are freshmen. Nothing against freshmen, but they're in that class and half of them don't realize they have to do their homework. And you can imagine what that does to you. And when that happens, actually, I've seen this kind of spread. In this class, not so often, the one danger, and you have to ask yourself if you're in that camp, that this may be what happened. Everybody did pretty well on this last exam. So if you found that you did pretty well and therefore you didn't sweat this class all that much, we're right now getting into where things are a lot more subtle, which probably we're going to figure out now, and you can't let up at all. You got to probably work harder. And so if you let up, then that's probably why I caught you. Now, sometimes you have good reasons to let up. I know, if you had three exams that week, okay, that's the way it is. So there's sort of an answer to your issue, but you do want to go through the exercise. I mean, obviously things are going really well for some people. Some of you shouldn't be so happy. You should go through the exercise and try to figure out what maybe happened, okay? There is also, and I'm open to this, it could well be that there was something a little bit weird with the exam structure such that you sort of either saw it or you didn't. But I'm not sure I really sensed that. I mean, I was looking at it. If you found you had a very particular problem, you want to let me know what it was, I'm fine with that. So do go through the exercise of thinking about it if you're down here, because that's not so good. I'd much rather see most of this tucked back up into something that's much more like a Gaussian, that's more coming up that I'm complaining about people who are getting involved. So, anyway, that's I don't know what else to give you about this exam at the moment.